It's around 6 on Sunday night, and you are tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is on the rich. The rich, as Scott Fitzgerald said, are different from you and me, and we're going to find out how and why. But these days, maybe they are you and me walking amongst us, and their names aren't Rockefeller or Mellon or Carnegie. They're names you've probably never heard of. Town & Country magazine recently did an article on just that, the 50 richest families you've never heard of. And number one is somebody I actually have heard of, because she gave a fundraising party for my ex when he made a stab out of nowhere at running for Congress. And it was in her gorgeous, expensive, but not overly fancy Hudson River home in upstate New York. Her name is Joan Davidson, and she runs the Kaplan Fund, which was founded by her father Jacob in the 40s to support civic life in New York. Jacob saved Carnegie Hall. It would have been torn down without him. The money comes humbly from Welch's grape juice. But for most of the past almost 100 years, the family have been great liberal philanthropists. The J.M. Kaplan Fund gives grants for human rights and social justice, as well as parks and clean water. Joan has served as New York Parks and Preservation Commissioner, founded Furthermore, a publishing program supporting the publishing of illustrated nonfiction books, and though well into her 80s, she sits on the boards of the National Resources Defense Council, the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum, and the New York Public Theater, as well as still being president emeritus of the Kaplan Fund that her son now oversees. As an aside, her niece, Isabel Fonseca, is married to the controversial English novelist and contrarian Martin Amis. Jonas said she thinks it's very hard for family foundations to pass on to the next generation because they can't agree. She says they piss away the money or they take on so many different things that they lose the focus. She says all these hedge funders and so on, they buy yachts. They don't do funding as far as I can see. She says, I'm proud of our family because I think we did pretty well. We started this philanthropy ball rolling and she's hoping everyone joins in. After all, a rich man is nothing but a poor man with money, according to W.C. Fields. The rich is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. So who else? What are these other names we've never heard of who are loaded? Okay, Brown, not a name that rings terribly rich, but George Brown from Louisville, Kentucky, made his fortune through making bourbon. And now it's the fifth generation sitting on the board of the company that makes Woodford Reserve, Old Forester, wine, and Jack Daniels. They're also a leader in sustainable business. Homer Stryker, based in Michigan, made his money through medical technology inventions during World War II. Now the third generation manages a $35 billion company, Stryker Corp. And the current main Stryker is John, an architect, philanthropist, and activist for environmental and LGBT causes. They've donated millions to Democratic candidates, and in particular, Jennifer Granholm in Michigan, whom they helped beat Betsy DeVos's husband, Dick. Not so honorable, the Sackler brothers, Arthur, Mortimer, and Raymond, who founded Purdue Pharma, which makes billions, mainly from that incredibly addictive drug OxyContin. But one of the daughters of the brothers, Marissa Sackler, runs an incubator for nonprofits, including the Malala Fund. And I guess OxyContin does help people when they're in dire pain. It's just rather worrying that if the rumors are to be believed, doctors are pushing it on patients and making a lot of money from the profits when those patients get addicted. I guess you have to decide how far down the chain you go to allot blame. And I don't think enough has been done to warn the general public about the hugely addictive effects of OxyContin. Maybe it's coming to light a bit now. So we have grape juice, we have alcohol, we have drugs making billions. How about rental cars? The Taylor family, also not a name that carries much cachet, but it was Jack Taylor who founded Enterprise Rental Car, a company that, when he died last year at 94, was seeing just under $21 billion in revenue. His son has acquired the Alamo and National car rental brands as well, while his daughter Joanne Taylor Kindall runs the Enterprise Holdings Foundation, which donated over $27 million last year. I guess that's still just only 10% of revenues, but still, they've given $860 million to local organizations, $50 million to Washington University, and $40 million to the St. Louis Symphony. Quick reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And my topic today is the rich. And I'm going through some people listed in a Town and Country article who are the richest people you've probably never heard of. But here's one. That's the name, But. Florence Butt. I had a friend, Annie, one of my closest friends in England. She married somebody called Butt. She went from being Annie Pugsley to being Lady Rufus Isaacs. She married a lord. To Mrs. Butt when she married David Butt. Anyway, this particular Butt, Florence Butt, opened the first HEB grocery store, a big chain of grocery stores in Texas. And now her son is CEO. $23 billion in sales last year. Not bad for a grocery store. Amazon obviously has taken note. And then there's John Dorrance, a name you might not know either. He was a chemist who masterminded the Campbell's condensed soup recipe in 1897. Since then, the company's expanded into Pepperidge Farm cookies and Prego sauce. You'll know those names presumably better than you know the name Dorrance. So we have soup and cookies. How about jeans? Not human ones, but blue ones. Bleu jaune, those French worker denims that became fashionable through Levi Strauss. That was a family called Haas, the widow of Peter Haas, who orchestrated that. Mimi Haas is now president of the family fund. She sits on the boards of New York's and San Francisco's Museums of Modern Art and is a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. And there's the famous later jeans manufacturer of more fashionable jeans, Gloria Vanderbilt, which is a name connoting wealth that we do all know. She's not only the progeny of a Vanderbilt, but also of a Whitney, and was the subject of a high-profile child custody battle when both her mother and her paternal aunt sought custody of not just her, but her $5 million trust fund. She's also known as Anderson Cooper's mum, and was the profile very recently of one of those Times Illustrated interviews where she was asked, if there were one thing you'd like to change about yourself, what would it be? And she answered, I'm too trusting. When asked which living or dead person she most related to, she said Madame Bovary, who notably lived beyond her means. But when asked which cartoon character she related to, she said Orphan Annie, and that her ideal last meal would be a bowl of rice pudding with 90 seconds mixed in just to be sure.
Go wrong.
You are tuned to the Sharon Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. The topic tonight is the rich. And we're hearing names we've never heard of who are super rich. Some of the names you probably have heard of, but might not know the families behind them. For instance, there's Cox, James Cox of Cox TV, or Cox Enterprises. He actually ran for president against Warren Harding, and when he lost, he started Cox, now a $20 billion media and auto conglomerate. Something you might not know, I certainly didn't. Cox publishes Kelley Blue Book, that manual you need when you're buying or selling a car. Sounds like they're all lefties, these super wealthy entrepreneurs, but obviously they're not. Diane Hendricks is the second richest self-made woman in the US. She made her money through roofing. ABC Supply Company, which is the largest roofing wholesale distributor in the country. Her donations helped elect President Trump. And these super-duper wealthy tradespeople aren't all Americans. Have you heard of the family Hartono? They're Indonesia's richest family for the 8th consecutive year. One of the largest suppliers of the clove cigarette in Asia. They also happen to own a majority stake in Bank Central Asia, which is Indonesia's largest lender and buoys the economy of the East. From clove cigarettes to masters of the universe.
Money is the answer.
You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX 935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is the rich. The richest names you may have never heard of. They're not all American, as I mentioned. India's richest man, Mukesh Ambani, heads Reliance Industries, country's largest exporter. If you own anything made in India, it likely came through the Ambanis. How about grain storage billionaires? W.W. Cargill founded his grain storage business at the end of the Civil War. Cargill Macmillan is now the largest private company in the US, leaving his clan with more billionaires, 14 of them, than any other family in the world. Their hands are on everything from the Argentine steak you're grilling to the liquid egg in your Egg McMuffin. And then there's the Mars family. You certainly will have heard of them. It's an $80 billion candy company at this point, but it also is a good supporter of the arts and donates heavily to conservation groups. Driscoll is a major controller of the $6 billion berry market in the US. Grandfather Joseph Driscoll founded the company at the turn of the century. That's the last century, and could be considered responsible for us being able to eat strawberries all year round at this point in the 21st century. So what do we average people think of these incredibly wealthy? Paul Piff, professor of psychology and social behavior at UCI Irvine here, thinks that being rich makes you mean. And he's presented his thesis in a TED Talk that I'm going to play you now on this KX935's Sharon Hour.
Think about playing a game of Monopoly. Except in this game, that combination of skill, talent, and luck that help earn you success in games as in life has been rendered irrelevant because this game's been rigged and you've got the upper hand. You've got more money, more opportunities to move around the board, and more access to resources. And as you think about that experience, I want you to ask yourself, how might that experience of being a privileged player in a rigged game change the way that you think about yourself and regard that other player? We ran a study on the UC Berkeley campus to look at exactly that question. We brought in more than 100 pairs of strangers into the lab, and with the flip of a coin, randomly assigned one of the two to be a rich player in a rigged game. They got two times as much money. When they passed go, they collected twice the salary, and they got to roll both dice instead of one, so they got to move around the board a lot more. And over the course of 15 minutes, we watched through hidden cameras what happened.
How many 500s did you have?
Just one.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I have three.
Okay, so it was quickly apparent to players that something was up. One person clearly has a lot more money than the other person, and yet, as the game unfolded, we saw very notable differences and dramatic differences begin to emerge between the two players. The rich player started to move around the board louder, literally smacking the board with their piece as he went around. Signs of dominance and nonverbal displays of power and celebration among the rich players. We had a bowl of pretzels positioned off to the side. That allowed us to watch participants' consumatory behavior. So we're just tracking how many pretzels participants eat. No surprises. People are on to us. They wonder what that bowl of pretzels is doing there in the first place. One even asks, is that bowl of pretzels there as a trick? And yet, despite that, the power of the situation seems to inevitably dominate, and those rich players start to eat more pretzels.
I love pretzels.
And as the game went on, one of the really interesting and dramatic patterns that we observed begin to emerge was that the rich players actually started to become ruder toward the other person, less and less sensitive to the plight of those poor, poor players, and more demonstrative of their material success, more likely to showcase how well they're doing.
I have so much money to take me for
a minute. I'm going to buy out this whole board.
You're going to run out of money soon. I'm pretty much untouchable at this point.
Okay, here's what I think was really, really interesting. At the end of the 15 minutes, we asked the players to talk about their experience during the game. And when the rich players talked about why they'd inevitably won in this rigged game of Monopoly, they talked about what they'd done to buy those different properties and earn their success in the game. And they became far less attuned to all those different features of the situation, including that flip of a coin that had randomly gotten them into that privileged position in the first place. And that's a really, really incredible insight into how the mind makes sense of advantage.
A quick reminder that you're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Currently listening to a TED Talk by Paul Piff, who is a professor of psychology and social behavior here at UCI Irvine. He's done research to show that as you get richer, you get meaner. Being rich is the topic of my Sharer Now tonight. And he's recruited participants for a rigged game of Monopoly to prove his point.
Now, this game of Monopoly can be used as a metaphor for understanding society and its hierarchical structure, wherein some people have a lot of wealth and a lot of status, and a lot of people don't. They have a lot less wealth, a lot less status, and a lot less access to valued resources. And what my colleagues and I, for the last 7 years, have been doing is studying the effects of these kinds of hierarchies. What we've been finding across dozens of studies and thousands of participants across this country is that as a person's levels of wealth increase, their feelings of compassion and empathy go down, and their feelings of entitlement, of deservingness, and their ideology of self-interest increases. In surveys, we found that it's actually wealthier individuals who are more likely to moralize greed being good, and that the pursuit of self-interest is favorable and moral. Now, I want to talk about some of the implications of this ideology of self-interest, talk about why we should care about those implications and what might be done. Some of the first studies that we ran in this area looked at helping behavior, something social psychologists call pro-social behavior. And we were really interested in who's more likely to offer help to another person, someone who's rich or someone who's poor. In one of the studies, we bring in rich and poor members of the community into the lab and give each of them the equivalent of $10. And we told the participants that they could keep these $10 for themselves, or they could share a portion of it, if they wanted to, with a stranger who's totally anonymous. They'll never meet that stranger, and the stranger will never meet them. And we just monitor how much people give. Individuals who made $25,000, sometimes under $15,000 a year, gave 44% more of their money to this stranger than did individuals making $150,000, $200,000 a year. We've had people play games to see who's more or less likely to cheat to increase their chances of winning a prize. In one of the games, we actually rigged a computer so that die rolls over a certain score were impossible. You couldn't get above 12 in this game. And yet, the richer you were, the more likely you were to cheat in this game to earn credits toward a $50 cash prize, sometimes by 3 to 4 times as much. We ran another study where we looked at whether people would be inclined to take candy from a jar of candy that we explicitly identified as being reserved for children. Participating, I know it sounds like I'm making a joke, we explicitly told participants, this jar of candy is for children participating in a developmental lab nearby. They're in studies, this is for them, and we just monitored how much candy participants took. Participants who felt rich took 2 times as much candy as participants who felt poor. We've even studied cars, not just any cars, but whether drivers of different kinds of cars are more or less inclined to break the law. In one of these studies, we looked at whether drivers would stop for a pedestrian that we had posed waiting across at a crosswalk. Now, in California, as you all know, it's the law to stop for a pedestrian who's waiting to cross. So the truck successfully stops in typical California fashion. It's overtaken by the bus who almost runs our pedestrian over. Car, a Prius, driving through, expensive car, and a BMW doing the same. So we did this for hundreds of vehicles on several days, just tracking who stops and who doesn't. What we found was that as the expensiveness of a car increased, the driver's tendencies to break the law increased as well. None of the cars in our least expensive car category broke the law. Close to 50% of the cars in our most expensive vehicle category broke the law. We've run other studies finding that wealthier individuals are more likely to lie in negotiations, to endorse unethical behavior at work, like stealing cash from the cash register, taking bribes, lying to customers. Now, I don't mean to suggest that it's only wealthy people who show these patterns of behavior. In fact, I think that we all, in our day-to-day, minute-by-minute lives, struggle with these competing motivations of when or if to put our own interests above the interests of other people. And that's understandable because the American dream is an idea in which we all have an equal opportunity to succeed and prosper as long as we apply ourselves and work hard. And a piece of that means that sometimes you need to put your own interests above the interests and well-being of other people around you. But what we're finding is that the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to pursue a vision of personal success, of achievement and accomplishment to the detriment of others around you. I've plotted the mean household income received by each fifth and top 5% of the population over the last 20 years. In 1993, the differences between the different quintiles of the population in terms of income are fairly egregious. It's not difficult to discern that there are differences. But over the last 20 years, that significant difference has become a Grand Canyon of sorts between those at the top and everyone else. In fact, the top 20% of our population own close to 90% of the total wealth in this country. We're at unprecedented levels of economic inequality. What that means is that wealth is not only becoming increasingly concentrated in the hands of a select group of individuals, but the American dream is becoming increasingly unattainable for an increasing majority of us. And if it's the case, as we've been finding, that the wealthier you are, the more entitled you feel to that wealth, and the more likely you are to prioritize your own interests above the interests of other people and be willing to do things to serve that self-interest, well, then there's no reason to think that those patterns will change. In fact, there's every reason to think that they'll only get worse. Now, economic inequality is something we should all be concerned about, not just because of those at the bottom of the social hierarchy, but because individuals in groups with lots of economic inequality do worse. Not just the people at the bottom, everyone. There's a lot of really compelling research coming out from top labs all over the world showcasing the range of things that are undermined as economic inequality gets worse. Things we really care about, physical health, social mobility, social trust, all go down as inequality goes up. Similarly, negative things, things like obesity and violence, imprisonment and punishment, are exacerbated as economic inequality increases. Again, these are outcomes not just experienced by a few, but that resound across all strata of society. Even people at the top experience these outcomes. So, what do we do?
Well, Paul Piff, psychosocial behavior professor at UCI, in this his TED Talk, brought to you now on the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lunas KX 93.5, has some ideas and prognoses.
These negative effects could seem like something that's spun out of control, and there's nothing we can do about it. Certainly nothing we as individuals could do. But in fact, we've been finding in our own laboratory research that small psychological interventions, small changes to people's values, small nudges in certain directions can restore levels of egalitarianism and empathy. For instance, reminding people of the benefits of cooperation or the advantages of community cause wealthier individuals to be just as egalitarian as poor people. In one study, we had people watch a brief video, just 46 seconds long, about childhood poverty that served as a reminder of the needs of others in the world around them. And after watching that, we looked at how willing people were to offer up their own time to a stranger presented to them in the lab who was in distress. After watching this video, an hour later, rich people became just as generous of their own time to help out this other person, a stranger, as someone who's poor, suggesting that these differences are not innate or categorical, but are so malleable to slight changes in people's values and little nudges of compassion and bumps of empathy. Bill Gates, one of our nation's wealthiest individuals, in his Harvard commencement speech, talked about the problem facing society of inequality as being the most daunting challenge, and talked about what must be done to combat it, saying, "Humanity's greatest advances are not in its discoveries, but in how those discoveries are applied to reduce inequity." And there's the Giving Pledge, in which more than 100 of our nation's wealthiest individuals are pledging half of their fortunes to charity. And there's the emergence of dozens of grassroots movements, like We Are the 1%, the Resource Generation, or Wealth for Common Good, in which the most privileged members of the population, members of the 1% and elsewhere, people who are wealthy, are using their own economic resources, adults and youth alike, that's what's most striking to me, leveraging their own privilege, their own economic resources, to combat inequality by advocating for social policies, changes in social values, and changes in people's behavior that work against their own economic interests, but that may ultimately restore the American dream.
And that's quite impressive, isn't it, in this day and age? And also that so many of the very wealthy are philanthropic. Maybe they didn't start out that way, but they're encouraged into philanthropy by their wealthy peers. There are all the names you know, of course, the internet billionaires, as well as the Bill Gates and Warren Buffetts of this world. They're giving huge amounts to worthy causes. So maybe after you get to a certain point of wealth, you stop being mean. The rich is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And I started the show by citing some names you may never have heard of that actually fall into the billionaire category. And the list is really quite long. Rudd is a name you might not have heard of, other than Paul Rudd, the actor. But I'm talking about Leslie Rudd, the founder of what's known as the Rudd Group. It's a family-owned portfolio of food and wine businesses, many in Napa. And a couple of years ago, he sold Dean & DeLuca, the fancy food store in New York, for $140 million. I remember selling our milk, our glass-bottled milk, when we started our dairy operation in upstate New York to Dean & DeLuca. Not for anything like $140 million. I think it was $2 a bottle. And here's somebody else that I have a personal association with. Kemper. You probably know Ellie Kemper as the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and from Bridesmaids and various other movies. I know her as the daughter of my husband's best friend at college and the sister of the baby that I babysat with my husband on our first date. Anyway, Ellie's dad, David, is now CEO of the Kemper Insurance behemoth, which includes various banks. Banking is a more obvious source of family wealth, but so is real estate. You may think you know who's the number one real estate mogul, but with at least 400 New York City properties, that name is Goldman. They're America's richest real estate family. They also have a stake in the New World Trade Center. So where else? Who are the other families that influence the world through their money? There's Mansour. They own all the country's McDonald's franchises, where originally the family was a cotton export company. They're also the world's largest distributors of GM vehicles. There's family Quant. Herbert Quant saved BMW from bankruptcy after World War II, and Suzanne Klatten Quant is the richest woman in Germany, who, as well as BMW, owns Rolls-Royce at this point. Then there's family Reimann, a 200-year-old German dynasty who avoid a spotlight, even signing pledges to do so when they're young. Their $19 billion company has stakes in Coty, Bally, Bellstaff, and owns the world's largest coffee company. And it's quite likely you're either drinking something of theirs or wearing something of theirs at this very moment. There's the Schaeffler family, who made their money through ball bearings. $28.6 billion is their worth, but they're also into computer hard drives, washing machines, blenders, fans, and anything else in your home that spins. Then there are the Christiansens, who own Lego. Kjeld Kirk Christiansen is the richest Dane with $21 billion. Then there's Bulgaroni, who were originally oil and now are specialty foods and wine. Think of them when you eat blueberries in winter. Then there's Ferrero, the third largest confectionery company in the world. I'm sure you've bought Ferrero chocolates as a last-minute gift at CVS in your life. But in the 1940s, the founder Pietro Ferrero added hazelnuts to save money on cocoa to produce what we now call Nutella. These days, the company is run by Pietro's son Giovanni, but it's his mother, Maria Franco Fisoli, who's Italy's richest person, with just over $25 billion, beating her son out by $1.5 billion. Let's not forget here that a billion is 1,000 million. I mean, 1 million is a lot of money. 100 million is a lot of money. 1,000 million is a hell of a lot of money. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is the rich, the richest people you've never heard of, people who are quietly stashing it away or have quietly stashed it away for generations and become billionaires, not through any mammoth achievement. Maybe they invented the ball bearing, maybe they sold pizza sauce, or just inherited their grandparents' winning recipe and the franchises it spawned. But a According to an article written by Kathleen Elkins, rich people, whether self-made or heirs, tend to view the world differently than the average person. And these are the ways in which they do so, she posits, herself quoting from self-made millionaire Steve Seabolt, who wrote a book called How Rich People Think, after spending a quarter of a century interviewing some of the wealthiest people in the world. He said that getting rich is not in the mechanics of money, but in the level of thinking that generates money. So here are the different ways rich people think than us average people think. Rich people believe being wealthy is a right, while we average people believe it to be a privilege. Seabold writes, in a capitalist country, they think they've the right to be rich if they're willing to create massive value for others. On the other hand, the masses think that getting rich is something simply reserved for a lucky few. In other words, the wealthy believe if they make life better or easier for others, they deserve to be rich. People who don't think they deserve to be rich just do the lottery and hope and pray. A second way rich people think. They believe starting a business is the fastest way to make money, while the average person is leery of that. The truth is, the rich think, that it's no safer to have a job than to own a business. And this has proved to be true, actually. People who work for themselves can be proactive in seeking out business. They can increase revenues at will. They think that the greatest risk is not betting on themselves. Us more average people will settle for our steady paycheck and miss out on the chance to generate a huge fortune. Seabolt says the masses almost guarantee themselves a life of financial mediocrity by staying in a job with a modest salary and yearly pay raises. Rich people believe the wealthy are more savvy. Even the average person believes that. But if the key to building wealth was excellent grades in school, every summa cum laude college graduate would be rich, argues Seabolt. Amassing money has more to do with street smart savvy than your ability to memorize information and excel on exams. Well, that may be true, but somehow when you develop street smarts, it seems you give up on something more ineffable.
Thoughts are a little cloudy, my feelings are around me. Yesterday's past, tomorrow's gone. I can't tell you what time it is. I'm not wise, it's just the way it is. If I were smart, wouldn't have a heart. If I were smart, I wouldn't have a heart. I was out of mind, and I can't stand the thought. Always prayed on the happiness you brought. 'Cause when you called me, baby, I'm needing you already. And you don't even recognize you're gone. Sands and hourglasses hit the ground. Millions of them lost and never found. If I were smart, I wouldn't have a heart. If we were smart, we wouldn't have a heart. If I were smart, wouldn't have a heart.
Almost makes you want to not be smart, right? But what if we want to be street smart so that we can be rich? Well, we're supposed to get inside the heads of people who are already rich, find out what they think and believe about money, which is what we're doing right here on this tonight's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, dedicated to rich tonight. We're currently finding out how the rich think, which is differently from us. Rich people believe building wealth takes a team, while the average person believes it's an individual effort. So we need to adjust our thinking to realize it takes a team to build wealth and find the right people to leverage our actions and ideas. According to Steve Seibold, who wrote the book How Rich People Think, the greatest fortunes are built through the collective mental and physical contributions of a world-class team. He says, who you surround yourself with has more of an effect on your net worth than you might think. You know, just think that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are great buddies. The rich seem to be buddies with other rich. Of course, that might be for other reasons. Once you get rich, you move in different circles. Also, you don't really want to be supporting somebody poorer. On the most fundamental level, you probably know it with your friends. The ones that want to spend a lot of money on a restaurant feel a bit guilty if you have no money. And vice versa, you feel a bit guilty if you're taken out all the time and can't properly reciprocate. So it just starts to happen that you kind of socialize more with people at your own financial level somehow. If you're rich, or once you get rich, you tend to mingle with the rich. Okay, so what are more ways that the rich think differently to the rest of us? Well, the rich believe that making money is simple, while the rest of us think making money is complicated. Seibold says, the masses have always thought that rich people are smarter, luckier, or more educated. And actually, none of these things is true. It's just that the rich know that money flows from ideas and problem solving. The bigger the solution to problems, the bigger the paycheck. Making money may not be easy, but it's simple. There's no mystery to getting rich. But this limiting belief that making money is very complicated is what stops the vast majority from even trying. Rich people know that money's earned through thinking, where the rest of us think it's earned through time and labor. A lot of us who aren't very rich are under the mistaken impression that the only way to earn more money is to work more hours. But the wealthy know to think of big money in non-linear terms, to realize that it's the creative thinking that brings in the big bucks. And if you want to make the big bucks, you have to train your mind to find solutions to difficult problems. That makes sense, doesn't it? Rich people believe money is liberating, while those of us who aren't rich believe that money will control us. I think I believe both. I've had money and I've not had money. And the advantage to having money is you can actually say go to hell to certain people and situations, which you can't do when you're poor and totally dependent on someone providing money through employment or other sources. But the rich see money only as a positive tool. They see the freedom that it gives you, where we might see that money can hold you in its thrall and take away your freedom. That, in fact, is the more common belief and probably the reason why we're not all really rich. Rich is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX935. Here's another way the rich think differently to us. Where the average person believes that they have to work for money, rich people believe that the only point of working is for personal fulfillment. They think that working for the sole purpose of making money is a terrible strategy for building wealth. They say if you look for something that has the most fulfillment, you're going to invest so much heart and soul into your work that you become one of the most competent people in your field. And when you have that possibly unique achievement is when you're going to be rewarded with uncommon wealth.
tell you life isn't just what you think. It's full of puzzles, still just a puzzle to me. And every time you think you're ahead, it's not what it seems. Life tends to happen while you're still making your plans. So dare to dream big, 'cause it's worth taking a chance. And when tomorrow comes, you will know you gave everything. So just do what you love and love what you do. There's so many things in life and they're all here for you. Just do what you love and do it for you. Smile every day. You can do anything. At times we find ourselves by the risk that we take. Turns out the best part, life is the love that we make. Seek the answers to all your questions. What can you see? We're all connected in life. We're all part of the same. The time we have here, short, but it's worth everything. No matter what, just know that there's nothing you cannot be. So just do what you love and love what you do. There's so many things in life and they're all here for you. Just do what you love and do it for you. Smile every day. You can do it. And at times it'll feel just like when it rains, it pours, you will see. And at times it'll sing just like all the walls closed in on me. Just gotta believe. So just do what you love and love what you do. There's so many things in life and they're all here for you. Just do what you love and do it for you. Smile every day. You can do anything.
We all think one day I'll be rich and everything will be wonderful, don't we? There's a quote that goes something like, "For the man with the toothache, just having teeth that don't hurt seems like the end of your problems." It's the same for the poor man or the not rich man or woman. They always think that being rich is going to be an end in itself to any hardship. Being rich certainly can mitigate some hardships, but it brings with it other problems such as, now what? Now there's nothing to blame. Does this person like me just because I'm rich? Will I stop being rich and lose what I have? How will I guard what I have? How will I value myself for what I am rather than what I have? Rich people's problems, those. Plus, being rich doesn't stop you being bored. To quote W.H. Auden, a tremendous number of people in America work very hard at something that bores them. Even a rich man thinks he has to go to the office every day, not because he likes to, but because he can't think of anything else to do. Very often the rich are the most bored, and the poor can't afford to be bored. Necessity, after all, is the mother of invention, according to Plato. According to financial guru Suze Orman, having enough money to buy everything you want isn't always as rewarding as it should be.
Don't buy something just because you can afford it. That's not the key. Buy what you need, no matter how wealthy you are. Because there does come a time when you have a lot of money and all of a sudden you bought a plane, you bought a boat, you bought five homes, you did this, and all of a sudden you look and you go, oh my God, I don't have any money. So just be smart. There was a time, it was back in 1998, and I knew I was going to be in New York a lot of the time, and I could afford $1 million penthouse at that time, but I didn't need it. So I purchased a $240,000 apartment back then in New York because that's all I needed. Buy what you need no matter how wealthy you are, and then you'll really be able to afford anything that you want. And you want to know what's so funny? You're not going to want anything other than what you need.
mystery to me. We have agreed with which we have agreed. And you think you have to want more than you need. Until you have it all, you won't be free. Society, you're crazy breed. I hope you're not lonely without me. There's those thinking more, less, less is more. But if less is more, how you keeping score? It means for every point you make, your level drops. Kinda like you're starting from the top. And you can't do that. Society, you're a crazy breed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Society, crazy indeed. I hope you're not lonely without me. Society, have mercy on me. I hope you're not angry if I disagree. Society, crazy indeed. I hope you're not lonely without me.
You certainly won't be very much poorer without me. Rich was the topic of my sharing hour tonight. If you want to hear it again, go to our KX935 website. Type the Sharon Hour into the podcast search menu, or you can hear it again on iTunes. But our website has details of our fabulous concert coming up, as well as all the other things KX935 has to offer, and all the other shows. And please do tune in for more Sharon Hours on KX935 every Sunday night at 6. This is Sharon James wishing you a world of riches, however you interpret that, and a great work week ahead.